Good evening, and welcome to the first Michigan Science Fiction Writers Reading of Fall Semester 2002. I'm Stephanie Mattson. I coordinate publicity for events like this, and tonight I'm filling in as MC for Leslie Beam, who's the coordinator of this series. It is my pleasure to introduce to you this evening Catherine Huliska Schaefer. Catherine writes both fantasy and science fiction. She attended MSU's Clarion Workshop in 1997, and has been writing seriously ever since. Her first publication, Improving Slay Times in the Common Dragon, was published in Odyssey No. 2 in 1998. Other published works include The World Opened Up for Me, an essay on the Clarion experience, published in Speculations in October 2001, and To Be or Not to Be, also published in Speculations in December 2001. Awards Catherine has received include the Ann Arbor Science Fiction Society's Clarion Workshop in 1997, L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future Contest and Honorable Mention in the first quarter of 2000, and L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future Contest semifinalist in the first quarter of 2001. Setting ambitious goals for herself, Catherine's plan for 2002 is to write a story of at least 5,000 words every 3 weeks, which she told me she was successful in for the first several months of the year. And this follows her 2001 resolution to write a story a month for 12 months. In addition, she has established a story a month group to challenge other writers. As an owner of ferrets, if one can be said to own a ferret, Catherine has also written several hilarious items about these animals, notably A Thousand Naps and a Nap and The Furry Plague. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me to welcome Catherine Huliska Schaefer.
Hi, thanks everyone for coming. Find my story in this magazine here. All right. This is Improving Slay Times in the Common Dragon. Abstract. An extract made from the juice of the Hesperidensian pomegranate, injected intramuscularly, will weaken the common dragon, Draco aeruginosa, sufficiently to allow a killing blow to the head or hearts. Richardson et al. In order to isolate and characterize this effect, four adult male dragons of the species Draco aeruginosa were attracted to our laboratory using Jaffronium's method and slain using either traditional methods or Richardson's technology. Richardson's method improved slay times by 34%. Ivan Quickblade arrived at Dr. Diabolsky's promptly at 10 o'clock. This was to be the first meeting with his new alchemy mentor, who would guide him to achievement of his wizard's robes. A sign reading Necromivor Diabolsky marked the lab entrance. The door opened easily at Ivan's hesitant touch. Inside was a maze of counters and shelves. Debris covered every surface. Arcanely shaped glassware, bottles of chemical, books, cathode ray displays, empty soda cans. Clouds of fog boiled out of a bucket of dry ice in one sink. The air buzzed. There was a movement in the rear of the room. Ivan ventured further inside. Hello? A black man with rasta braids appeared from behind a stack of books. He greeted Ivan with a nod. I'm looking for Dr. Diabolsky's office. The man pointed across the room. Behind two rows of lab benches, a door hung ajar. Thanks. I'm Ivan. I'll be joining your lab. He extended his hand. Larry. He turned and sauntered away, humming to himself. As Ivan sat in the cluttered office, he wondered how the mentor-student relationship would unfold. Certainly, there would be long hours, frustrations, setbacks, even resentments in his graduate career. But this man had experienced it all, and they shared the same passion, alchemy. At 11 o'clock, he emerged from the office and approached Larry, who was working at the sink. Do you know where Dr. Diabolsky is? Larry chuckled. Nope. The smell of rotted meat surged up from the sink, and he realized that Larry was cleaning partially defleshed human bones there. He worked with all the unconcern of a master chef carving a leg of lamb. Ivan tried not to gag. Is this usual for him? What? Well, not being here when he's supposed to, I guess. Larry rinsed a vertebra under the faucet and turned to face Ivan. Let me explain something to you, man. Follow me. Larry led him to a wall with a map of the castle grounds. Undulating contour lines covered it. Now, I assume you're familiar with Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Ivan nodded. Well, you see, Dr. D exhibits both wave-like and particle-like behavior. On a hunch, we applied Heisenberg's principle and created this surprisingly accurate map of his location. Bits of flesh clung to Larry's finger as he jabbed the map. What? Where is he then? Slow down, my man. We can either determine his velocity or his position, but not both. Fortunately, Necromivore's velocity is not very interesting to us. Larry shifted on his stool and tapped the map. This, my friend, is a necromivore density map. Necromivore density? Yes. Now you'll remember from your studies of quantum mechanics that electrons in their orbitals can be described by a wave function. And rather than being found at any one position in orbit around the nucleus, we imagine them as a cloud of electron density. The pi orbital, for example, is like a barbell with two bulbs of electron density at the ends and a narrow isthmus between. Yes, 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 Ivan glanced at his watch, 11:15. Where was that man? Well, this shows us an necromivore density cloud. Ivan squinted at the map, and suddenly it came into focus. There was a cluster of density around his apartment, the privy, the delicatessen, and the sheep pens. Materials and methods. 20 kilograms of Hesperidensian pomegranates were obtained, seeded, and juiced. The juice was fermented and distilled to yield 1 liter of pomegranate extract. 4 adult male dragons were captured using Jeffronium's method. NIH permit for research on human subjects number 501J6. The cardiac output for all 3 hearts was monitored with biometronic EEG. The experimental dragons were dosed by Remington hypodermic 100-pound recurve bow. All dragons were sacrificed with Rory 9000 Super Slasher, model TX-24. You've got to be kidding. This thing isn't even calibrated. Ivan hefted the Rory Super Slasher. Its balance was uneven, imprecise. It was obsolete by more than a decade. It's all we've got, Larry shrugged. But how about the Slash Tech Vorpal Blade XLT? Anyone in the department get one of those? Nope, I'm afraid not. We're the only lab left doing blade work. The other groups are working on lead-to-gold conversions, love potions, etc. His big tropical print shirt fluttered in the breeze. You're kidding, right? But the reason I came to this university was its reputation in the martial arts. The Rory is fine. You'll have to calibrate it manually, and it doesn't have some of the fancy features of the Vorpal Blade, but it's reliable and enchanted. Remember, our grandfathers were killing dragons with nothing more than sharpened bamboo spikes. No adjustable grip, no safety guard, no glowing digital display. Shit, said Ivan. He swung the Rory through the basic forms as Larry sauntered away. It put far too much pressure on his wrists. He wondered if he could up the output on the propelling field a tad to make up for the slap and the swing. Too much of that would give him blisters. An elegant weapon for a more civilized age. Ivan jumped. A dwarf was standing behind him. What? You must be Ivan Quickblade, he extended his hand. Ned Diabolski. Ivan gaped, ignoring the hand. For 3 days he had received vague messages from Diabolski via Larry, who never seemed to leave the lab. He'll meet you at 3 tomorrow, or he wants you to read these articles, or here's a super slasher, calibrate it. So far, he had never shown up for a meeting. I looked for you everywhere, your rooms, the deli, the privy, the sheep pens. Diabolski's eyebrows rose, and he withdrew his hand. I guess you missed me. He was mostly bald, with tufts of gray hair around his ears, and wore bicycle shorts with elbow and knee pads. I see you've got a good start on your project. Let me get a cup of coffee, and we'll go over the details. Diabolski drifted toward the courtyard entrance. Ivan, relieved to have met his mentor at last, collected his notebooks and went inside to wait. Now he would finally begin the difficult journey to power. He could almost taste the medallion of magnificence resting on his breast. He thought about what he would say in his acceptance speech. Of course he would thank his mentor, and he might mention his mother. It was over an hour before he realized Diabolski was not coming. Results. Table 1.1 summarizes the effect of various stimuli on the heart rate of the Draco aeruginosa. Dragons 1 and 2 were dosed with 100 mils of pomegranate extract. Dragons 3 and 4 were slain in their natural state. The stimuli measured were A, singed by reflection of own fire, B, stabbed to the upper palate, C, severing of the distal tarsals, D, broken clavicle, E, incision between the 4th and 5th cervical vertebrae, and C, cardiac laceration, single only. The girl stood comfortably lashed to a post below a hillside several miles from the castle wall. She wore denim bell-bottoms slung low around her hips and an insect-green sweater. Her uncombed hair had a calculated 4-day coat of oil. It was pinned back on one side and hung loose, partially covering her face on the other. Excuse me, I have an appointment. Could you hurry up? She gestured urgently with her chin. 3 dragons lay dead at her feet. I'm doing the best I can, Ivan said. The trouble had started with the super slasher malfunction during the last round with Dragon 3. It barely had enough power to accomplish the final cardiac laceration. Then he had spilled the pomegranate extract. Now they had a situation. The volunteer had been told that there would be no risk involved and that she would go home at 5. In truth, there was a significant risk involved if they did not dispatch all of the dragons quickly. Jaffronian's method of attracting dragons relied on the propensity of Draco aeruginosa to develop an appetite for virgins on the night of the full moon, midnight to be exact. It was well past sundown already. Who does that kid think she is, ordering us around? Ivan dropped the super slasher in disgust. Serena Lova Royal Anishka? What? The king's daughter? Yep. Larry seemed unconcerned. He was playing drums in the air while Ivan jiggled the super slasher styles. Then why didn't we get a different volunteer? If her father finds out she's here, our heads will be decorating the palisades. Fine. If you can find another virgin over 18, we'll use her for the next study. But this was the best we could do for now. There isn't going to be a next study. I can't work with this junk. Ivan kicked the super slasher where it lay. To hell with it. I'm going back to my room to order pizza. Why don't you get Ned over here to deal with this? Larry's laid-back manner evaporated. Now wait a minute, thick blade. Let me tell you a few things. I am not here to run errands for you. I'm here supervising your ass. If you want to tell Ned something, you run over and do it your own damn self. Larry jabbed him in the chest. Ivan realized for the first time that Larry was several inches taller than he. But I'll save you some time and tell you what he'd say. He'd say, you're the one that wants those robes. You're the one that wants the power. You find the solution. Otherwise, you'll never be more than what you are now, a second-rate technician. Ivan sighed. He looked out over the valley. The three corpses, the live dragon at ease, the girl staring plagues and damnation at him. What made him think he could be an alchemist? Maybe he really was a washout technician. Find the solution? My sword is broken, and we've got 3 hours until midnight. Ivan hated the whine in his voice. Just what do you suggest? Look around you. Improvise. Ivan turned in a circle. They were in foothills that flanked the Black Mountains. Stands of bamboo dotted the vales that nestled in the foothills. Bamboo. No. Wait, you don't mean. Why not? I can't. It's too dangerous. Someone in your family had to have some guts. The name is Quickblade, right? Ivan sighed and looked at the tableau. Serena Lova slumped in her ropes and stared at the stars. Well, he was a Quickblade after all. Okay, if you'll just help me. No way, man. My soaps are on. I'll see you tomorrow. Larry gestured vaguely with one hand as he turned to go. Conclusions. Although the study was marred by equipment malfunctions, the data in Table 1.1 shows a clear correlation between the use of the pomegranate extract and the depression of the circulatory system in the rampant Draco aeruginosa. Overall slay times were 34% faster, Table 1.2. It was half an hour before midnight when Ivan finished sharpening his bamboo spike. He wrapped his right hand around the grip and caught a splinter in his left when he tried to cock it. The spike was different from any weapon he had ever wielded. There was no hum, no gauge to watch, no battery, no fuel cell. Ivan estimated that the upkeep would be extremely simple. It would likely require simple weekly tuning and lubrication. Dragon 4 waited for him in a moonbeam below. It was perhaps 2 human body lengths long and the color of dry grass. It wasn't the appearance of the dragon that was so chilling, but rather its culinary habits. Dragons are frequent raiders of manure piles and outhouses. It was really only in the cases of virgins and full moons that they gave up their caprophagy. Ivan held his breath against the reek, raised his shield, and charged down the hill. He was able to administer the first of the experimental abrasions with his shield. He skipped the palate pierce for a moment and went directly for the tarsals. This is where he encountered his first problem. Without the super slasher's turbo assist, he couldn't penetrate the dragon's hide with the tip of the spear. A sudden burst of fiery breath caught him off guard and singed his hair before he made a clumsy retreat to the hilltop. "Damn you, Four," said Ivan as he wrapped the grip of his spear with a cloth. He felt the beginnings of hate, but it wasn't all directed at Dragon Four. He hated Larry for leaving him in a difficult scientific situation. He hated Diabolski for abandoning him to Larry's supervision. And he hated Serena Lova for putting not only his scientific career but his life at risk. The cloth eased the pressure on his palms. He looked for some way to add a turbo assist to the spear. When he could find nothing, he took a few cleansing breaths and ran down the hill. Four swatted him out of the way just as he was about to administer the tarsal laceration. Damnation! He had taken a hard bump to his big toe on the way back up. When he stopped cursing long enough to examine it, he couldn't tell whether it was broken or not. He put his boot back on. The limp would skew his aim. Ivan began to appreciate the super slasher. Certainly it was obsolete, and the turbo assist didn't work right, but it worked. Now his thrust would be weak and laterally unbalanced, and he could not correct it because, unlike the super slasher, the spear did not come equipped with sway bars. Ivan raised his shield, bellowed, and rushed down the hill. Again, this time he didn't even reach the bottom. He tripped over his broken toe and fell. You know there's a better way, don't you? Ivan jerked his head out of the grass. Fora was staring at him. You talking to me? Who else? If there's a better way, I'd like to know it now, because I need to kill you in the next 5 minutes. Easy. Fudge the experiment. I can't do that. My reputation. What reputation? You're a green apprentice. No one knows your name and no one cares. Do you think that Diabolski never fudged an experiment? He's the one who'll get credit for this escapade anyway. True, but how do I keep you from eating Serenalova? They both looked at the sleeping princess. She drooled a little and murmured something. Do you really care? No, but her father might get angry. And if I fudge the data and Serenalova gets eaten, they're going to know that it's fake, right? Look at it this way. What is more important to Diabolski, her life or publishing this study? Ah, I see your point. So you're saying that Ned will cover for me in order to publish the data? Exactly. What's in it for me? Well, first, I won't kill you. That spear is no defense, I'm afraid. Four stretched, his back arched, and his twin tails cracked audibly. My ancestors killed dragons with this. Yes, but they were using the sharp end. I have a better offer for you. Four leaned conspiratorially towards Ivan. It's really power you're after, not an academic reputation, right? Well, I guess. Have you considered studying dragon magic? It has far greater depth than your pathetic human alchemy. Ivan considered weighing the benefits of a continued presence in Nekromovor Diabolski's research group against learning the secrets of dragon lore. Having his name in alchemy paled in comparison to the thrill of flying, of living for 1,000 years, of breathing stardust and sunshine. And dragon magic involved no peer review or yearly grants. Will I have to eat compost? Fora made a sound that might have been a laugh or a roar. That's the spirit, my boy. You have much to learn. Will I get tenure? Another roar. And her? Fora's lips curled back in a dragon grin. Do you know how hard it is to find a virgin around here? That's that one. So, I don't know, there's 7 minutes left. Should I go on?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? Okay. All right, this is a short one. I have to warn you, though, this is an adult story. It has explicit information about Santa Claus. All right, long winter's nap. Eat, said Moon and Mama. You have a long winter ahead. Little Swan turned her head away as Moon and Mama lifted the spoon of raspberry pie dripping with honey and caribou fat. Little Swan was sleepy, too sleepy for what she planned. I am already full, said Little Swan. Her stomach rumbled, giving away her lie. Moon and Mama shrugged and set the plate away. It was beginning to get cold in the cave as the crackling fire burned down to embers. Soon it would be time to sleep. Time to dream of spring when they would awaken, shivering, to find that Santa Clar had visited them. Moon and Mama lay next to Yeti Daddy and pulled Littlest One down between them, like a baby. All of the others had their own beds. The hardest part was lying still between Moon and Mama and Yeti Daddy without falling asleep. It wasn't like going to sleep at night. There were no blankets to keep them warm, though they had soft beds. More than once, Littlest One shook herself awake after accidentally nodding off. She wasn't sure she could fight off the long sleep by simple force of will, not with the cold coming down into her bones. She peeked out from beneath her heavy lids, and the cave was dark except for the thin, crackly lines of orange from the dying embers in the fire pit. The taste of sugar rose to her tongue, and her hands and feet began to tingle. Moon and Mama was still. Her breath was coming softer and fainter each time. Her bright blue eyes were closed, and her cheeks soft as a baby's. Chestnut hair fanned around her shoulders. Her breasts rose and fell softly with her breath. Yeti Daddy wasn't breathing at all. There was a faint beard of frost on his face, decorating the stubble on his chin. All around lay Littlest One's brothers and sisters, their children, her aunts and uncles and cousins, her grandparents, and all the other people of her tribe. In the summer, when the tribe slept, there were all sorts of sounds in the night, people coughing, snoring, and sometimes laughing. But here there was nothing but a deep silence. Littlest One stood up and shook the tingling out. She felt a pang of longing looking at her parents hibernating, but it wasn't enough to keep her with them. She turned to sneak out. She felt dizzy and stumbled several times as she tiptoed across the sleeping bodies of her tribe. Nothing would wake them now but spring. Littlest One crawled out of the cave and went to the summer house that Yeti Daddy had built. She lit a fire and crouched beside it. When she felt completely awake, she went out into the night. It was snowing softly, and there weren't any stars. She had never been so alone. but she resisted the temptation to go back to the cave with her family. She imagined what they would say when she told them she had met Santa Claus. They wouldn't think she was such a baby then. The days were lonely for littlest one. It grew colder, and all she wanted to do was go to sleep. Many times she woke herself just on the verge of hibernation and had to get warm again so she wouldn't miss Santy. She knew where to find food, even under the snow. Moon and Mama and Giddy Daddy kept caches of meat and potatoes underground where they wouldn't go bad. There were some nuts and berries left on the bushes, and she didn't need to eat much since she was so small. Digging through the buried boxes, littlest one wondered why there was so much food with the feast that Santa Claus would be bringing. To fight off the loneliness, she sat up on top of the highest hill and looked out over the water. The Hots had called it Saginaw Bay. The wind blew, raising ridges of white up out of the gray sea. She cracked a walnut with a rock and wondered how long it would be before Santa Claus came. The snow was as deep as her ankles. She liked to bury her feet in it and wiggle her toes until they popped out like mice. She lay down and stared at the cloudy sky. It was like being rocked in Moon and Mama's arms. She could still hear the sea nearby, crashing against the shore. It was never this angry in the summer. The wind blew, bearing the bitter scent of snow. The birds flew away, and the snow fell. More snow than littlest one had ever seen before. Cold wind howled down out of the north, slapping her in the face with the scent of pine needles and deep gray water. The nights became quieter, broken only by the occasional cry of a wolf. Littlest one thought she heard the creaking of the glacier, making its slow journey towards their village. One night, a sound made littlest one sit straight up in her bed. It was a peeper frog, croaking all by itself in the swamp. Littlest one hunted for it all the next day, calling, "Papa Rana, Papa Rana." She found him and took him home inside her cupped hands. "You're waiting for Santa Claus too, no?" In a clay jar by the fire, the peeper frog crouched, moving its gullet up and down. Littlest one appreciated the company, but even more, the frog represented a blessing from the ancestors for her quest. He was the wise and ancient ancestor Rana, who had taught her people to hibernate so that they could stay in their homeland when the ice came. Papa Rana had married a human woman, and their children had become Littlest One's tribe. If Papa Rana waited for Santa Claus, staying awake against the approach of winter, so could she. Yeti Daddy's summer house got too cold. It was built of sticks and couldn't keep the wind out. Littlest One could not sleep there anymore. To keep warm and not to fall too deeply asleep at night, she had to listen to the wisdom of the squirrels. In the fall, squirrels built a nest inside a hollow tree and lined it with leaves. The more leaves they put in, the warmer it was. This was the learning passed down through the tribe from the first ones. It took a long time to find a hollow tree big enough for Littlest One. When she crawled inside, she had just enough room to lie down curled up in a ball. She collected lots of leaves and dry grass from beneath the snow and stuffed them inside. She carried the jar with the peeper frog to the hollow tree, but when she got there, he wasn't inside. "Now I am truly alone," she thought. The peeper had no doubt gone beneath the ground and fallen into hibernation, his insides bathed in blood thick and sweet as honey. Littlest One forgot to count the days, and Moon and Mama was not there to remind her. That was why she didn't know how long she'd been on her own when the Hots arrived. Snow was pouring down like rain. They flew out of the storm in a shiny metal airplane shaped like a fish and landed right in the middle of the tribal meeting grounds. The bare dirt of the dance ring was covered with snow, so it looked like any clearing in the woods. At first, Littlest One thought that it was Santa Claus, but there were no reindeer, and when the door opened on the giant silver fish, a family came out, not a fat man in a red suit. There was a mama and a daddy in that family, and two children near Littlest One's age. She thought that if they had children, they must be friendly people, so she went out to greet them. Because they were Hots, they wore a lot of clothes, great jackets that went up over their heads with fur ruffs, and giant shoes that went almost to their knees. They hid their hands inside a soft pair of shoes wrapped a cloth around their necks. The snow fell so heavily that at first the family didn't notice her when she stepped out of the trees. The mama screamed and the children just stared. When the screaming stopped, the daddy coaxed her out of the woods and they took her into the flying fish. Its stomach was a narrow room, soft benches covered with short, bright red fur lined one wall. There were cupboards on both long walls and windows on the sides that looked out into the snow. A small table sat to one side. The mama, mopping tears from her eyes and making little gasping sounds the whole time, dressed her in some lumpy clothes. Perhaps they were planning a religious ceremony. Littlest One could think of no other reason to wear so much clothing. The mama and daddy went inside a compartment separated from the stomach of the fish by a curtain. The daddy was communicating with some other Hots by pressing buttons on the inside wall. "About 8 years old," she heard him say, "wandering naked in the woods." The voices inside the wall sounded like they were talking in a windstorm. Stay inside the vehicle. Rescue team will arrive as soon as possible. Poor visibility. The mama whispered to the daddy, quietly scolding him for getting them lost in a storm. There was another daddy fussing at the stove with a pot of hot water. The children called him Nanny. He had very pale skin and no hair and wore metal bands around his wrists and neck. The children were excited to meet Littlest One. Where are your parents? The girl asked. She had long, blonde hair hanging in two braids down the side of her head. Her name was Yubik. They are sleeping, said the Littlest One, under the ground. Yubik opened her eyes wide. You're all by yourself? Littlest One nodded. I'm waiting for Santa Claus. The boy, who was several years younger than his sister, jumped up and down. Santa Claus, Santa Claus, he said. His name was Sybik. The blonde girl smiled and leaned close to Littlest One. I've seen him, she whispered. We're going to spend Christmas with my grandma in the mountains. And I sent him a letter saying he should bring my presents here on Christmas Eve. What's Christmas Eve? Asked Littlest One. She doesn't know what Christmas Eve is, said the boy. It's when Santa flies all over, bringing presents to every boy and girl. He couldn't visit all of them in one night, said Littlest One. She was disappointed. He visits all the children on all the planets, in all the galaxies, all in one night, said Sybik, on Christmas Eve. The blonde girl nodded. Tonight is Christmas Eve. But what if we don't get to Grandma's in time, said the boy. Santa won't be able to find us out here by the glaciers. I sent a message to Santa, giving him our coordinates. He has good lights on his sleigh, said the daddy, ducking through the low doorway between the front of the fish and the body. Turning to Nanny, he said, as soon as the blizzard stops, they'll send a rescue team out to pick up the girl and any other survivors. They gave me instructions to treat her for hypothermia, but when I told them she was uninjured, they became very interested. Littlest One sat on her knees with Yubik and Sybik on the cushioned bench beneath the window in the side of the fish. Together, they peered through the glass out into the night. It was black dark, and they could see nothing but thick snow swirling madly inches from the glass, like a wall of milk. Littlest One could have watched it all night. We'll have Christmas Eve right here, said the mama. Come, Nanny, let's get everything ready. Nanny and the daddy and the mama reached behind hidden doors inside the flying fish and got out plates piled with food and bright ribbons and colorful gold balls and strings of tiny lights. They laid a splendid meal on the tiny table. There was a platter of steaming meat and vegetables, golden-crusted pies with sweet juices leaking out, and hundreds of candies colored red and white and green. Music began to play, coming from somewhere above Littlest One's head. Nanny handed each of the children a curly red and white candy. Thank you, said Littlest One. The mama laughed suddenly, as if Littlest One had thanked the cook stove or the music box. Nanny raised one eyebrow. You are welcome, he answered. Nanny set a nativity scene out, and the children gathered around, admiring the animals and the wise men. Where's the baby Jesus? Said Littlest One. A silent pause followed, and everyone stared at her blankly. The best part of the feast was the walnuts. The daddy set out a bowl of walnuts and some nutcrackers made out of metal and began to crack them. She hardly ate any of the meat and pies because she had so many walnuts, and with the clever nutcrackers, it was easy to get them open. But even though everyone was having a wonderful time, Littlest One felt confused. It's as if Santa Claus has already been here, she said. Yubik and Sybik laughed. No, he brings the presents, said Sybik. Littlest One looked at him. Presents? She asked. Yes, you'll see tomorrow. Every spring when Littlest One woke up, there was a feast laid out of venison haunches and tiny sweet cakes and candies made of maple syrup and all the walnuts she could eat. There were bright decorations hung from the trees and dried fruits and dancing and singing. And at the end of the day, Woodchuck Mama always gave her a special gift. Last spring it had been a doll made of cloth and stuffed with sweet-smelling dried summer grasses with glass beads for eyes and straw hair. Littlest One already knew that Woodchuck Mama had been working on a beaded dress for her to wear dancing, and that would be her gift for Christmas this year. Would that be what Yubik and Sybik expected Santa Claus to bring them? Perhaps Santa Claus didn't really visit the Hots after all, and it was just the parents that made a Christmas celebration. Littlest One smiled and tried to learn the songs the children were teaching her, but inside she felt as if she might cry, because she was certain that Santa Claus wasn't coming to the flying fish that night after all. Suddenly, the door to the rear compartment of the fish burst open, and Nanny came in, dressed in a red suit and a white beard. Yubik and Sybik jumped up and down, cheering. I told you he would come, said Sybik. Littlest One glanced between Nanny and the mama and Daddy. Daddy was saying, come on in, Santa. You're just in time for the celebration. Nanny sat down with Yubik on one knee and Sybik on the other. The children's eyes glowed, and Littlest One could tell they really believed that Nanny was Santa Claus. She wondered if the parents believed it, too. They couldn't possibly, but by now she would believe anything about the crazy Hots. "What are your Christmas requirements, Ubik?" said Nanny Santa. Ubik told him. She listed dozens of items that Littlest One had never heard of. Then Cybik took his turn and did the same. When they were done, Littlest One was offered a turn in Santa's lap. She declined, and Santa stepped out into the snow. "I will deliver your gifts between midnight and 0100 hours," said Santa. After a while, all the food disappeared, and the children began yawning and rubbing their eyes. Nanny reappeared in his regular clothes. Ubik begged to stay up a little later, claiming she wasn't tired. Cybik cried and demanded that Nanny leave him alone. Nanny wrestled the Littlest One into a garment the Hutts called pajamas. It covered her body from the neck to the feet. It felt like a steam bath on the inside. "How may I assist you to fall asleep?" he asked her. "I am programmed with 1.7 million lullabies and 13,000 human languages." "Nothing, please," said Littlest One. The mama and daddy slept above the flying compartment, and the children slept on a bed that unfolded from a bench. Littlest One was squeezed beside Ubik with the big kids, not stuck between a mama and daddy like a tiny baby. Nanny slept on the floor with no blankets, like a dog. Littlest One could feel the heat building in her body, especially her feet, each in its own sack of blanket fabric. She kicked aside the quilt that Nanny had put on top of her and the other children, but it didn't help. At least she wouldn't fall into hibernation inside the Hutt's flying fish, but she couldn't get any rest either with the warmth flooding her body. Soon it was silent, except for the heavy sighs of the sleeping Hutt family. Littlest One pulled down the metal tab that held her clothing on and slipped out of it. Then she lay on top of the blanket. She was so warm she couldn't stop fidgeting. She wanted to get up and run and jump, but she didn't want to bother the Hutts. Finally, she fell into a fitful sleep. She woke to hear voices. The three adults were moving silently around the room. They pulled a colorful black boxes from a compartment high above their heads and whispered to each other. "Look at her," said the daddy. "Naked as a jaybird." "Should I cover her?" asked Nanny. "No," said the daddy. "The Washington people think she's some kind of transgenic. Most likely she's comfortable that way. They've already got a team ready at the National Hospital to study her." "Transgenic, isn't that illegal?" said the mama. "It wasn't always," said the daddy. "There were dozens of isolationist political factions at the time of the diaspora that may have used transgenic technology to survive the Ice Age," said Nanny. "Poor thing, I'm putting her name on some of Ubik and Cybik's gifts," said the mama. "They'll never know." After a long pause, the mama spoke again. "Seems cruel to take her away from her home. Do we really have any right?" "A child wandering alone in the wilderness? It would be cruel to leave her here," the daddy answered. "It would be different if her parents were still alive to care for her." Littlest One watched them through eyes open barely a slit while she pretended to sleep. When they were done piling the presents, they each ate from a plate of cookies and the daddy drank a glass of milk. Then they went back to their beds. Littlest One lay still, but silent tears rolled down her cheeks because she knew she would not see Santa Clara that night, because the presents Cybik had talked about were already here, stacked up to the ceiling, more presents than Littlest One had got from Woodchuck Mama her entire life. When she was done crying, because no one could cry forever, Littlest One began to think about her own tribe's Christmas celebration. When she woke up in the spring, Moon and Mama and Yeti Daddy and the other adults were already awake. They must have prepared all of the food from underground caches and laid out the feast while the children still slept, then woke them when it was ready. That would explain why the candies that Santa Clara brought tasted so much like the ones that Swamp Under Mama made for the Harvest Festival, and why Moon and Mama spent so much time collecting pine cones in the fall. It was a great game, making a surprise for the children, and Littlest One had never known it. She smiled in the dark because she couldn't wait to tell Moon and Mama and Yeti Daddy what she had learned. More than anything, this would prove to them that she wasn't a baby anymore. She knew a secret that not even the big kids knew. Moving slowly and softly, so as not to wake anyone, Littlest One crept out of the bed where she lay with Ubik and Cybik. None of them stirred, except for Nanny, flat on his back on the cold, hard floor. She put one foot over him and froze while he rolled his head back and forth. Then, quick as a snake, his hand was around her ankle, and his yellow eyes were open. "The lavatory is there," he said. "Otherwise, children are required to remain in bed until 0600 hours. Littlest One met his gaze. His eyes looked human, except for their color. They were moist and ringed with lashes. His skin was faintly scaled. She wondered if there was a Papa Rana for people like him. "Please," she said, "it's too warm in here." Nanny's grip on her ankle loosened, then let go. He looked at her for a long time. Then he put his arm by his side and closed his eyes. Would he be punished? Littlest One wondered. Then she had a sudden image of the mama scolding the stove or the refrigerator for malfunctioning. She shuddered. Comforting coolness penetrated the door through its metal parts, soothing Littlest One's hands when she touched the handle. Whispering one final farewell to the Hatt family, she opened it and ran into the night. The blizzard raged on, but Littlest One found her way to the cave, even through the snow, her footsteps disappearing almost as soon as she made them. She lay down between Moon and Mama and Yeti Daddy and let hibernation take her, finally. That's it. Jim.
What's the best part about being a writer?
The best part? I think it's finishing a story after working really hard on it, finishing it and printing it out and setting it on a pile on my desk. Yeah?
What's the difference between science fiction and fantasy?
It's a very, very fuzzy line. Science fiction usually has science in it, but sometimes you can't tell whether it's science fiction or fantasy. Pretty much, it's what you think it is, I guess. I don't know, that's a hard question.
I got a question.
Yes?
Who are some of your favorite authors?
My favorite authors? Let's see. I like Orson Scott Card very well, and I'm reading George R. R. Martin's series right now, and I like that a lot, tremendously. And I can't think. It's hard for me to say what's my favorite anything because I'm very indecisive. It's easier for me to say what I really hate.
Is there somebody's writing style that you admire so much that you would like to write like them?
I'm very insensitive to style. I guess I mostly appreciate just a clear, transparent style. And I don't notice so much if someone's writing in a bizarre style, unless it's really obtrusive. I read The Shipping News by Annie Proulx last year, and that I noticed. But I got used to it, and then I didn't notice it anymore.
Yeah. How do you know when a story is done? You stop working on it?
Well, I never really do know that it's done. I think maybe one or two of my stories I felt that were really done, that I finished and I rewrote them, and I got a version that I thought was just perfect, and that's happened maybe twice out of, I don't know, 20 stories. And the rest, I don't even read them, because every time I read them, I find something that needs to be improved. In fact, I did in both of these while I read them. So neither of these are finished either. Yes?
You talked about short stories. Anything longer?
Oh, you know, I'm working on a novel. Yeah, I am. I'm working on a novel. It's not science fiction or fantasy. It's a mainstream young adult. It's a novel for girls about swimming. And that's coming along pretty well. I have an editor who's interested in it, and I'm hoping to get it sent out to him this month. And then I will probably wait for 6 months or a year and have my heart broken, but that's how it goes.
So where do you usually get your inspiration?
Everywhere. A lot of times it's from the newspaper or magazines that I read or, I don't know, stuff that I see. We were driving up here and there was the most incredible rainbow, 180-degree rainbow, and it was bright. And then there was a ghost rainbow in front of it and a ghost rainbow behind it, and I started thinking about a story idea. So, you know, they come out of nowhere. No more?
Well, thank you again.